This is a true crime in real time update from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
I'm Tony Bruschi, and welcome to the Hidden Killers podcast. Today, we dive headfirst into the chilling developments unfolding in the courtroom of the Richard Allen trial, the man accused of the horrific 2017 murders of Abby Williams and Libby German. If you thought this case couldn't get more shocking, today's testimony and evidence just rewrote the script. It's hard to forget the Monongahela Bridge, the last known location of the girls, now etched into the nation's memory. But what we've learned inside the courtroom today was unlike anything we've seen or heard before. Graphic crime scene photos, emotional testimony, and a jury visibly rattled. The defense is pushing back hard, trying to limit what jurors see and hear, raising questions about how evidence is presented and whether it tells the full story. But beyond the legal battles, there's the unsettling reality. Two young girls, their lives brutally taken, and a community still searching for answers. What kind of mind can commit such an act? What unseen forces were at play, psychologically or otherwise, that led us here today? Hold on tight. This is one story where every twist leaves you questioning everything you thought you knew. The courtroom was silent as Indiana State Police Sergeant Jason Page took the stand to describe the crime scene. On February 14, 2017, he had arrived at the area later dubbed Ground Zero, where the lifeless bodies of 13-year-old Abby Williams and 14-year-old Libby German were found. The testimony gripped the room as prosecutors began presenting 43 crime scene photos, each more unsettling than the last. The images were not for the faint-hearted. Gasps echoed from the gallery as a mistakenly projected close-up of Libby's bloodied face filled the courtroom screen, visibly unsettling jurors and family members alike. The photos revealed eerie details. Libby was found nude, her body positioned near a tree, with large branches deliberately placed on top of her. A larger limb extended from her left shoulder down her body. Abby, in contrast, was fully clothed, her dark blue sweatshirt still damp, indicating recent exposure to water. Her right knee was slightly bent, with one foot tucked beneath the other leg. Witnesses described how both girls had been left with what appeared to be heavy branches partially concealing their bodies, though not in a way that suggested ritualistic staging. During his testimony, Page explained the bloodstains found at the scene. The area was saturated with a large quantity of blood, he testified, pointing to violet-stained markings on a tree treated with a chemical to make the blood visible. Jurors learned that Abby's and Libby's bodies were found just off a flat floodplain near the creek, surrounded by woods. The location, remote yet unprotected, raised questions about whether the killer had intended to hide the bodies or if the branches were merely an attempt at quick concealment. Sitting in the courtroom, Richard Allen, a 52-year-old Delphi resident, showed little reaction as the horrific details were recounted. At times, Allen rocked back and forth slightly in his seat, a subtle but noticeable movement. His defense attorney, Andrew Baldwin, kept a steady presence, occasionally placing a reassuring hand on the back of Allen's chair. Allen's wife and parents sat quietly in support, their faces a mixture of exhaustion and uncertainty. Detective Darren Giancola of the Carroll County Sheriff's Office testified about his role in the two-day search for Abby and Libby. Although off-duty at the time, he had volunteered to help find the missing girls. The search ended in tragedy when Giancola arrived at the cemetery near the scene and was directed toward the creek. I saw a multicolored shirt and a black and white shoe floating upside down in the water, Giancola recalled. Moments later, he stumbled upon the bodies, Libby's nude form first, followed by Abby, still in her damp clothing. As he testified, Giancola admitted that it was immediately clear the girls were dead. There was no need for CPR, he said somberly. Both girls had visible throat wounds, and the blood on and beneath their bodies suggested a violent end. The prosecution emphasized that the crime scene had been properly secured, disputing any defense claims that evidence had been tampered with or disturbed. The defense, however, was quick to file motions seeking to limit what jurors could see and hear, particularly the video and audio captured on Libby's phone. This video had become central to the case over the years, with the grainy footage showing a man now known as the Bridge Guy walking along the Monon High Bridge. The haunting command, "Down the hill," uttered in the recording, had become one of the most discussed pieces of evidence. Defense attorneys argued that the recording had been enhanced by investigators and played on a loop to make the audio more distinct. They insisted that the state's use of these techniques could unfairly influence jurors who might interpret the sounds differently without such enhancements. They further argued that the recording, while widely recognized, had not directly identified Allen as the suspect. In the gallery, Libby's mother wept quietly as her daughter's final moments were discussed. Family members leaned in, offering what comfort they could, though the emotional toll was evident. Jurors, too, seemed visibly disturbed as they processed the horrifying evidence presented before them. The defense aimed to challenge the narrative that Allen was responsible. With his arrest coming years after the murders and based on circumstantial evidence, they sought to sow doubt about the investigation's thoroughness. The defense raised questions about the handling of evidence from the creek area, hinting that crucial material could have been washed away. Yet, the prosecution maintained its focus, methodically presenting evidence and testimony that painted a chilling picture. While theories of Odinism and ritualistic killings had captured public imagination, there was little in the crime scene photos to support those claims. The images and witness statements pointed to something more straightforward, if no less horrifying, a brutal murder carried out with chilling intent. As the courtroom proceedings continued, tension mounted. With every photo and testimony, the narrative of what happened on that fateful day in February 2017 became clearer, but questions still lingered. What had driven the perpetrator to commit such a heinous act? Was this a crime of opportunity or premeditated evil? Allen's trial had only just begun, but the emotional weight of the evidence was already taking a toll on everyone involved. The jury, the families, and even the legal teams found themselves grappling with the enormity of the crime and the burden of seeking justice for Abby and Libby. The day ended with jurors excused for the afternoon, many still processing what they had witnessed. Prosecutors promised more key witnesses in the days to come, including forensic experts who would offer deeper insight into the physical evidence gathered from the scene. Allen's defense team remained firm in their resolve, prepared to challenge every piece of evidence presented against their client. The question now wasn't just who killed Abby and Libby, but how the trial would unfold in the weeks ahead, and whether justice would be served for the two young girls whose lives had been so tragically cut short. As the trial continued, the focus began to shift from the immediate crime scene evidence to the broader context of the investigation that followed the tragic events of February 2017. The years-long search for answers had gripped the small town of Delphi and captivated true crime enthusiasts nationwide, but the investigation was anything but straightforward. Piecing together what happened required understanding the people involved, the timeline of events, and the decisions made by law enforcement at every step. Richard Allen's arrest in 2022 came as a surprise to many, not only because of the time that had passed, but also due to Allen's low profile in the community. A pharmacy technician and local resident, Allen had no prior criminal history of note. For years, the case appeared stalled, with police releasing only snippets of information, including the infamous Bridge Guy video, which gave the public a glimpse of the suspect but few concrete leads. The Monon High Bridge, a deteriorating rail bridge abandoned long ago, had become the focal point of the investigation and the setting for the girls' last known moments. Libby German's quick thinking on the bridge recording the man walking toward them had given police a critical piece of evidence. However, identifying the man in the video proved challenging. The release of two separate composite sketches over the years led to public confusion and, according to some, may have hindered the investigation more than it helped. Investigators initially considered several persons of interest, some with criminal backgrounds or connections to the area, yet, as the months stretched into years, frustration mounted among the victims' families and the public. Rumors and theories swirled, ranging from random predator theories to organized crime connections and even bizarre claims involving occult rituals. The introduction of Odinism as a potential motive by the defense would later raise eyebrows, although it was ultimately excluded from the trial as irrelevant. The psychological dimensions of the case also drew attention. What kind of person would be capable of such a brutal crime? Experts on criminal behavior noted that the nature of the killing suggested a combination of anger and control, possibly someone with personal grievances or deep-seated emotional issues. Profilers suggested that if Allen were indeed guilty, the murders may not have been planned far in advance, but could have been an impulsive act triggered by a confrontation or perceived slight. Yet, as the defense would later argue, the lack of prior violent behavior in Allen's history raised doubts about whether he fit this profile at all. In the years before his arrest, Allen remained in plain sight. He continued working, participating in his community, and living a seemingly ordinary life with his wife and family. This fact alone added to the mystery. How could someone responsible for such a heinous crime blend so seamlessly into small-town life? The psychological tension between Allen's mundane existence and the monstrous crime he allegedly committed became a key point for both the prosecution and defense. Investigators eventually connected Allen to the crime through a combination of witness statements, cell phone records, and forensic evidence. However, much of the case against him remained circumstantial. The lack of direct DNA evidence on the bodies added another layer of complexity, prompting debates about how reliable the Creekside evidence was after so many years. Had crucial traces been washed away by water? Had time and exposure compromised the scene? These questions loomed large over the trial, with both sides prepared to argue their version of the truth. The prosecution leaned heavily on Allen's behavior following the crime, including his reported admissions to being on the Monongahela Bridge Trail on the day of the murders. This admission placed him near the scene, though it did not directly link him to the crime. His defense countered that there was nothing inherently suspicious about being on the trail that day, especially given how popular the area was with locals. The phone evidence also became a point of contention. The prosecution argued that the timeline of Allen's movements paired with Libby's recording created a compelling case. Yet the defense sought to undermine the relevance of the bridge guy footage, arguing that it was impossible to definitively identify Allen in the grainy video. They suggested that the recording had taken on an almost mythic status in the public consciousness, complicating the task of finding an impartial jury. Public pressure and media coverage played an undeniable role throughout the investigation. For years, the families of Abby and Libby fought to keep the case in the spotlight, appearing on news programs, podcasts, and social media platforms. The outpouring of public support for the victims was heartening, but it also led to complications. Armchair detectives flooded online forums with theories, sometimes overwhelming investigators with false leads and unfounded speculation. Managing public expectations became as much a part of the case as following the physical evidence. Allen's arrest brought a sense of relief to the families and the community, but it also raised new concerns. Some wondered if law enforcement had rushed to arrest Allen under pressure to show progress. Others questioned whether there were additional suspects still at large. The defense hinted at this possibility, suggesting that Allen could have been framed or at least wrongly accused while the real killer remained free. The environmental challenges at the crime scene also added to the complexity. The creek where the bodies were found had likely disrupted potential evidence, and the remote location made it difficult for investigators to secure the area thoroughly in the hours following the discovery. Still, the prosecution argued that the evidence gathered was sufficient to prove Allen's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. At the heart of the case were the families of Abby and Libby, who had waited years for answers. Libby's mother, in particular, had been a constant presence in the courtroom, supporting the prosecution and enduring the emotional toll of seeing the evidence firsthand. The family's grief and determination to seek justice gave the trial a deeply personal dimension, reminding everyone involved that this was not just a legal matter, but a quest for accountability and closure. The trial also forced the small town of Delphi to confront difficult truths about safety, trust, and justice. In a community where everyone knows everyone, the idea that such a brutal crime could occur and that the alleged perpetrator could live among them was almost too much to bear. The trial proceedings became a way for the town to process its collective trauma, even as it laid bare the divisions and uncertainties that remained. As the trial progresses, new testimonies and revelations will continue to shape the narrative. For now, the focus remains on establishing a clear picture of what happened that day on the Monongahela Bridge and whether Richard Allen was truly responsible. But behind every question of guilt or innocence lay deeper questions. How well do we really know the people around us? And what unseen forces drive someone to commit the unthinkable? I'm Tony Bruschi, and after all the testimony, the photos, the evidence, and the motions from both sides, one thing is clear. This case is as complicated as it is heartbreaking. Abby Williams and Libby German were two young girls who should have had the world ahead of them. Instead, their lives were brutally stolen, and the search for their killer has haunted a small town and captivated a nation. Sitting through the trial, you can't help but feel the weight of every detail. The crime scene photos were more than just images. They told a story of violence, confusion, and loss. Both Abby and Libby faced unimaginable fear in their final moments. And with every testimony, whether it was the investigators recounting their search or the families trying to hold it together, you realize that this isn't just a legal matter. It's about two families seeking answers, two lives cut short, and a community trying to find closure. But then there's the other side, the man on trial, Richard Allen. His presence in the courtroom raises more questions than answers. How could someone like Allen, a seemingly ordinary pharmacy technician, be connected to such a horrific crime? Is he guilty, or is he a convenient suspect in a case that had gone cold for years? The defense's efforts to limit evidence and control the narrative suggest they believe in his innocence, or at the very least in the idea that reasonable doubt remains. The phone recording of the so-called bridge guy is one of the most critical pieces of evidence. It's been played, analyzed, and debated by the public for years. But does it offer the proof we need? Or has the media attention surrounding it shaped our perceptions beyond what the evidence actually shows? That's the challenge this jury now faces, seeing through the noise and finding the truth hidden in the facts. This trial isn't just about what happened on February 13th, 2017 on the Monongahela Bridge. It's about the failures, the persistence, and the relentless search for justice that followed. It's about how law enforcement managed a high-profile case under the scrutiny of a community and a nation desperate for answers. And it's about the psychological toll on the families, the town, and yes, even the jurors, of witnessing such raw evidence of human brutality. But at the end of the day, justice is a tricky thing. It's not just about finding a guilty party. It's about finding the truth. And the truth is rarely straightforward. Was this a crime of opportunity, a planned act, or something else entirely? We may never fully understand what motivated the person who killed Abby and Libby, but what matters now is what happens in that courtroom. If Allen is guilty, justice must be served swiftly and decisively. If he's not, we have to ask ourselves the hardest question of all. Where do we go from here? What if the person responsible is still out there, hiding in plain sight, just like they have for the last 7 years? These are questions only the jury can answer. But as we move forward, one thing remains constant. Abby and Libby deserve justice. They deserve more than theories, more than speculation. They deserve the truth. And it's up to this trial to deliver it.
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed? for so long.
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.